So this week will be devoted to discussing randomization theory and randomization group in quantum field theory. I know that you have already been introduced to some aspects of randomization, both in quantum theory with Dan. I think you discussed the one loop diagram for 5-4, and in, of course, in QED, in QFT1, because you have seen the randomization of the mass of the electron and the wave function of the electron in QED. So, still, I'll start by some introductory lecture in order, because that's an important feature, and I'll go up to the aspects of randomization group to some calculation about randomization at one loop in gauge series, probably next week, last week. A bit of relation with what we are presently, I think, or have already seen in quantum, in statistical mechanics, about application of randomization group in for the study of critical phenomena. So I hope after the end of those two lectures, you'll have some, hopefully, global view. So that's an important feature of quantum theory, of quantum field theory. So if you are lost, if you have questions, if you have inquiries, if you, of course, if you spot typos in my lecture or errors, just raise your hand. Okay, so randomization today. So, first, let me remind what we have discussed at the end of last lecture. We have seen that already at the level of the scalar field theory, the simplest theory, so the scalar field with an action which is integral d dx 1/2 of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared, that's a scalar free field. When studying the basic object, which is the vacuum expectation value of products of two fields, which is, in fact, the only quantity you have to compute, because by Wick's theorem, you can compute any vacuum expectation value of operator in the vacuum out of this object. Already, the propagator, G0 of x minus y, which is, let's work in Euclidean, in the Euclidean space-time, but we have seen that the short distance problem occurs are the same. They occur at coinciding point in space-time, both in Euclidean space-time and in Minkowski space-time. Okay, so we have seen that this behaves like some divergent power of the distance between the two points. And in fact, I didn't give a factor, but basically in four dimensions, this is 1 over 4 pi squared x minus y to the power minus 2 in d equal 4. In d equal 2, this is minus 1 over 2 pi log of, and then it's x minus y, there is a factor of 2, but it's not important, and in fact here the mass is important because you cannot write out a log of something which is dimensionful. So the mass is important. Here the dominant term doesn't depend on the mass, so that's in d equal 2. And in general dimension, you get a factor x minus y to the power 2 minus d, with some coefficient depending on d. That's going to be important. The following, and therefore, this means that when x goes to y, if you consider as a quantum operator the product of two fields, phi of x, phi of y, so x and y are in space-time, this object, considered as an operator, is singular. It goes to infinity. And that's a feature of quantum field theory. It's present as soon as the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 2. So it's a problem which is not present in quantum mechanics, but which is present in quantum field theory. And that's a feature. In fact, to understand why this is really generic is just perform some dimensional analysis. Assume that you are just an engineer and you perform what is called engineering analysis, dimension analysis, but of course, theoreticians are somehow some, you know, abstract engineer, but you still need to give some, even if you are not doing experiments, one needs to get some sense of real. That's what happened. Okay. And if you do some dimensional analysis, this is an action for a field. This is an action, phi. This is the action. And well, express in the correct, you know, unit of system of units where h bar is 1, say so consider that then. And if h bar equals c equals 1, that's a choice of system of unit, you see that the action has to be dimensionless because in the functional integral, for instance, exponential minus s or minus is. So s is dimensionless. So if you consider what are the dimension in terms of length minus 1 or energy, momentum, the action is dimensionless. So let's call this the dimension of the action by this. The dimension of the action is 0. Of course, the dimension of the distance is minus 1. And the dimension of a mass is an energy by Einstein equation, E equal m. And so the mass parameter has dimension 1. And so the action has dimension 0, x has dimension minus 1, so this has dimension minus d. So the dimension of the field is, this has minus d, so you must have a d factor from this. You have a 1 coming from the derivative, so the dimension of the field is, if I'm not mistaken, d minus 2 over 2. That's for a scalar field. Of course, that's for a scalar field. It's going to be different from the Dirac field, and it's going to be different from the gauge field. But that's an exercise. And you see that the dimension depends on the dimension. The dimension of the field depends on the dimension of space-time. D is the dimension of space-time. And therefore, if you consider the products of two field operators, this is an object which has dimension in terms of inverse of length, d minus 2. So this object has dimension d minus 2. So if at short distance you have x, you have y, and you are considering how this operator should behave as a function of the distance between the two points, because of Lorentz invariance, it has to be just depending on the square of the x of the distance of the line element x minus y. This has to be behaved like that. So this implies that it behaves like that. Of course, you see it from the integral representation from the explicit form, but that's the reason. Phi phi, it's a non-local operator, but when you try to make it local, it's divergent just because of its dimensionality. Okay. So, and this is going to go, well, this is important because you can repeat the same analysis for the interacting theory and see immediately where, whether or whether not there will be some, whether there not be, will not be some problems or whether there will be some problems. Okay. So, well, before discussing the interacting theory, I'd like to just discuss a bit more this operator. You may ask, can we make sense of an operator phi squared, the square of two fields at the same point? So that's something that, in fact, you have seen in QFT 1 or in quantum theory. So the question is, can we make sense of phi squared as an operator, local operator of X, as a local operator. Okay, and well, we need it because it's something that appears in the action. It's something that appears in many quantities. Okay, and well, naively, it doesn't make sense because if you insert the products of those two operators in any, you know, vacuum expectation value, if you compute the matrix element of this non-local operator, when you make it local, the matrix elements diverge because of this divergence. Okay. So, but there is a solution which is known, I presume you have seen, as so in the sense of making a composite operator. So this is called the composite operator. It's composite with respect to the basic subject with, for the quantum field theory, the field operator. But composite means just that it's more complicated. Physically, this is an operator which should be as sensible as this one if it exists in the theory. Okay. And so, can we make sense of this? Yes, because in the free, think about in the free theory. You compute some vacuum expectation value of those two operators, phi of x, phi of y, and some other phi, phi of x1, ta 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 ta, phi of xn, in the free theory, and those ones are fixed. But you can have any of them. And out of that, you can compute all the matrix elements of this object. Okay? And think about the in Feynman diagram, what this means. So you have your field operator at x, phi of y, and you have all the other ones. And you apply Wick's theorem. And so you have to count all the contraction between the points. And you have two kinds of contraction. First, you have the contraction where you have your point x1, xn, you have your all points xy, and you have the Wick contraction where you consider the contraction between x and some of the x1, xn, and y. Some of the one xn, that's an example, okay? And then in addition, you have, and of course you have, you make Wick contraction between the other one. And you have this one, this one. And it is this one which is problematic. But it's problematic, but the divergence is proportional to something divergent, x minus y to the power 2 minus d times something local when x equal y, which is basically, you see, you have no contraction between, you have no Vic interaction between this and this. So this this is just the operator identity. This is just the operator 1 at, let's say, x plus y divided by 2, if you want, to be symmetric. So the divergence in any expectation value of products of operator at different points, when x goes to y, is proportional to this product of operator times 1. So this is something like x minus y to the power 2 minus d times this correct coefficient times the operator 1 located at x plus y divided by 2, but 1 is just gives 1 in the expectation value, times the other 1, plus something irregular. Okay. When x goes to y. And this something irregular is the sum of this operator. So when x goes to y, it's just given by, and here you have a phi squared operator with Vic contraction between those two. And this one is not divergent. As long as the point x plus y minus 2 doesn't come close to x1 up to xn, that's regular. So this regular, you can define it just by some new operator, let me call it phi squared of x plus y divided by 2 times phi of x1, phi of xn, where this object is just this minus this. So this, I put, so that's an operator of x plus y over 2. It's just defined as a limit when x goes to y of the operator, original operator, non-local operator, minus the divergent term, which is phi of x, phi of y, that's the propagator. Now that's a number. You see, that's a function c of x minus y times the operator 1 at x plus y divided by 2. So that's an operator. That's a coefficient. And both this operator and this coefficient are divergent when x goes to y, but this defined as an operator exists. It's well defined. And the Feynman rules to, when you compute correlation function, is that you are allowed to make a Vic contraction like this, but you are not allowed to make a Vic contraction like that. This is now forbidden to define this well-defined operator, you see. Okay. So this operator defined in this way is called, depending on the normal product or normal ordered product of two phi operator. Okay. Hope you see what this means. Okay. And now, if you think of this formula as a formula on operator, you see that those two operators, phi x times phi y, tends toward this well-defined operator plus an additional term, which is quantum, of quantum origin. It mixes the operator 1 with the divergent coefficient. You see that you can rewrite this simply as phi of x, phi of y, when x goes to y, behaves like, let's keep the most dominant. It's c of x minus y times 1 x plus y over 2 plus phi squared of x plus y over 2. Okay? So this is the simplest example of what is called an operator product expansion, or OPE. So it's an operator product. The expansion means expansion at small distances. You take the products of operator at different points, the non-local, you take the local limit, you have an expansion in which involves, in general, several operators. So you get the normal product, the usual normal product, but you get an additional term, divergence. So phi squared mixes with the identity operator. With a coefficient, and the coefficient is divergent and is given by dimensional analysis, divergence. Okay. So this OPE is some feature which was present in quantum theory since the beginning. But in fact, the importance of the fact that you have an expansion, a short distance expansion for products of operator, an OPU, has been, well, first emphasized and then used in physics by Ken Wilson. So it's often called the Wilson operator product expansion. This was in the end of the 60s. Okay. Okay. And of course, this is a particular example, but that's true in general. In general, you can define composite operators, more complicated, like phi 4, phi 6, the derivative in the action, etc. And they all have a short distance operator product expansion. So this is a general feature of quantum field theory. General feature of QFT. Okay. Well, that's, I think that's all what I want to say at that stage, but keep that in mind. Oh, and finally, one last thing. The fact that this composite operator, which are defined in here by an operator product expansion, they are often called normal product, but because in canonical quantization, this corresponds to make a normal order of the creation and annihilation operator in canonical quantization. And I presume that you have seen that in QED and in for the free field. So there is a, you know, just the dictionary works. By replacing products where you have a dagger and a dagger a by just a dagger a, I think you get rid of the dangerous terms. You have a sum over momenta, on-shell momenta, and which gives divergence. So this corresponds to this. That's a useful exercise. You can check that. Okay. So. Now let's discuss some more involved things. Now, for an interacting theory, the simplest example of interacting theory is the phi 4 one half of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared plus the coupling constant, well, normalized with the factorial of 4 for convenience, phi squared. So for interaction theory, you have seen already, or for QED, you have seen that when you go from tree level, where you apply Quick theorem, you have no interaction, everything it contains in this divergence. When you go to radiative correction, or one loop order, and so on, you encounter Feynman diagrams, the simplest one being this one, which contains ultraviolet divergence when you integrate over the internal momenta, because you integrate, you encounter dimension like this, or squared, you encounter ultraviolet divergence here at d equal 2, and here at d larger or equal to 4, which are the consequence of this singularity. Okay? And of course, this has puzzled physicists for a few decades, let's say 2 decades, until the theory of renormalization was invented and started to be developed by, well, there was of course Schwinger, Feynman, and Tobanaga for QED. In fact, before that, there was Stueckelberg, a bit before, Swiss theoreticians. And then it was extended and became what we're going to present. But the first idea before understanding everything was to modify the behavior of the theory, to modify, improve the short distance high energy momentum for the theory. And then take the limit where we recover the usual theory. So that's somehow a trick, an important trick of what is called regularization. And then taking a continuum limit, and that's something that we physicists understand very well, and that some mathematicians still now, although they made first a lot of progress in understanding what physicists are doing and a lot of progress in developing a mathematical theory of renormalization, which is sometimes even better than what the physicists do, they still, often some mathematicians think this is some black magic. But this is not some black magic, and we are going to explain what it is, not black magic. Or, stated in a more material way, putting the ultraviolet divergence under the rug. Okay, not black magic or under the rug trick. Okay. But that's important to discuss this issue of renormalization because that's an important tool. And in fact, it goes back to even the 30s when physicists discovered this problem. They immediately try to think, and I think I've read in some historic book about the history of quantum physics that I think it might be Heisenberg, who in the 30s said, aha, maybe space-time is discrete at short distance. Okay, so let me first present a few of the tricks which are available in the literature. So basically, the problems come from the fact that the propagator is singular at short distance, or the integral diverge. So you can first modify the theory in momentum space. So you can, for instance, replace the propagator, which is basically in momentum space, like that, by stating that it's okay for momentum of k squared less than some ultraviolet cutoff. And after that, it's zero, for instance. That's called the sharp cutoff. Propagator is this, and it's zero for k squared larger than lambda squared. That's called the sharp cutoff. We are often going to use that because for crude calculation at one loop, that's enough. There is no physical interpretation of that, but we replace everywhere the propagator 1 over k squared plus m squared by zero if some of the momenta are larger than zero. Okay. Now there is a more improved version of this because it can correspond to some quantum field theory, which is called the Pauli-Villar regularization, which consists in again, you have a ultraviolet scale, large, lambda, momentum scale. So you can replace this by 1 over k squared plus m squared times lambda squared divided by k squared plus lambda squared. So you see that, of course, lambda squared has to be much larger than the mass of the theory. And as long as the momenta are much smaller than lambda, this is one, this behaves like the ordinary propagator. The propagator behaves like 1 over k squared. But when the momenta are of the order or larger than lambda, this behaves like lambda squared divided by k4. So you have improved the behavior of the propagator. And for instance, you make this integral convergent. Actually, you make also this integral convergent. Well, no, you make this integral logarithmically divergent, and you make this integral for this graph convergent. Okay. The advantage is that this is a modification of the propagator with a k squared. So it's Lorentz invariant, or Poincaré, in fact. Poincaré invariant regularization. Okay. But the problem is that you can rewrite this modified regularized propagator as something like that with a lambda squared minus m squared, or something like, I presume. No, Okay, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, you see. So you see that this propagator, where you have, you can view it as a propagator where you have two propagators, one with a particle of mass m and another particle, another field with mass lambda.
Sorry, there should be a lambda square on top, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. Yes. Yes, of course, that's this lambda square. Thank you. Okay. So you see that you can view this as a propagator where you have the propagator as a pole at k squared equal minus m squared, another one at k squared equal minus lambda squared, but with a minus sign. And a propagator which has a pole corresponding to one particle state with a negative norm means that it's a ghost. You have negative probability. So you have a problem with unitarity. Okay. So that's one kind of regulator, and there are other ones. Another one, which is of course very useful in physics, is to replace continuum space-time, Minkowski 1D or RD in Euclidean setting, by a lattice. Well, some lattice, the simplest one being a lattice, the simplest one being a lattice L, which is a z to the power d, so you have a square lattice with a mesh A. And basically, this is a distance regulator. And A is the analog of 1 over lambda in our case. So we have a short distance. Regulator. That's something which is done in, of course, to make the connection with statistical mechanics. It's something which is used in discretization of gauge theories called lattice gauge theories. So it preserves a lot of things. But, of course, Poincaré invariance is replaced by the discrete lattice symmetry. Rotation are just discrete rotation and translation, tac, 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 tac. Okay. So you have to be careful if you use this kind of regulator to see whether you can define a continuum limit. And then there are more involved regularizations that I think you might have met already, which are called analytic regularization. Well, there are different ones. There are one which is called the zeta regularization, very important in gauge theories, but the most famous one is called dimensional regularization. It was invented by some Giov Battisti, well, some in the beginning of the 70s, but it was most developed and cleverly used by Toft and Veltman for gauge theories, because it's a regularization that respects gauge invariant. Well, actually, lattice, a gauge theory can be properly defined on a lattice, and it still has a discrete gauge symmetry. This is called a Wilson, in fact, another physicist, Wegener, developed it for the Ising model. Probably at the same time, lattice gauge theory. But this, in this analytic regulation, space-time stays continuous. So you have some Poincaré symmetry, But you replace the dimension of space-time, which is 4, by a dimension of space-time, which is 4 plus epsilon, or minus epsilon. So we consider that the dimension of space-time is complex. And in fact, complex. So of course, physically, it's a bit problematic. Nobody has been able, I think, as a mathematician, to define what is a quantum field theory in a space with non-Negger dimension, and they have tried. Many have tried. But you can define scattering amplitudes and Feynman integrals. You can still define Feynman integrals and scattering amplitudes. For a following reason, which will appear when I'm going to do calculation, for instance, on this graph, if you consider the Feynman amplitudes or the scattering amplitude, if you put the momenta on shell for such a diagram like that, you see, this diagram depends basically 1, 2, 3, 4. It depends on the total momenta p, which is p1 plus p2, and of the mass. And basically, when you compute it, you integrate over k, you integrate this, you perform this integration over k. And this integration, if you work it properly, if you define it properly, I think I'm going to do that later on, you can consider that it comes out that you can compute in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dimensions. And it has a form of a function where d is a parameter. So in fact, this, let's call it it's a bubble diagram. It's a function of p1 plus p of p. Well, it's a function of the mass, if you have a mass parameter, but in fact, you can define it when the mass is 0. And it's a function of the dimension. And the dimension, in fact, turns out to be an analytic parameter. It's an analytic function of d. And the fact that it is singular on dimension cart comes out by the fact that it has a pole in 4 minus d from some regular part of d. So using this trick of considering space-time as non-integer, if you follow the rules, which have to be precise, the ultraviolet log lambda divergence, if you use a sharp cutoff or a polyvillar regularization, or it's going to be log lambda or log of 1 over a, if you are using a lattice, it becomes a pole at d equal, a single pole at d equal 4. So it's not very physical, but ultraviolet divergence becomes poles. The amplitudes are, in fact, meromorphic function. So get a meromorphic. Meromorphic is a mathematical of D. It's a function which has poles. It could have more singular, but it turns out that it has only poles. In general, only poles, not cuts, logarithmic singularities. That's an important aspect. And you can analyze the structure of the ultraviolet singularities of the theory by studying the analytic structure of a meromorphic function. And that's very convenient for calculation, because in particular, this regularization respects gauge invariant, while you can do lattice gauge theory and define a theory which is gauge invariant, but you get very complicated Feynman rules because the propagator becomes complicated, but this can be done. And here, this kind of just modifying the behavior of the theory in momentum space in general breaks gauge invariance. Okay. Well, so this is a general panorama of what the tools we are going to use. And after the break, I'll start to discuss the normalization of phi-4 theory. Well, first the structure of infrared divergence, and then the renormalization of phi-4 theory in one dimension. In four dimensions. Okay? At one loop. Okay, thank you. So, let's meet in 5 minutes.
Just the integral of that. Okay.
made a mistake?
Second law just means it converges if d is greater than 4. Right? If it's equal to, then it'd be a logarithmic divergence.
Yeah.
Okay, let me start again. So now I'll consider the interacting 5-4 series. That's the simplest series that you have seen already. This series. Oh, I didn't brought my. And you have seen that in dimension 4. In fact, already in dimension 4, but the naive perturbation theory has ultraviolet divergence. In fact, this is expected just from the dimension analysis arguments that I've seen here. Because if you follow the same argument, phi has dimension d minus 2 over 2, so phi 4 has dimension 2d. Minus 4. This has dimension minus d. So this term has dimension d minus 4. So for phi 4, the Copley constant has dimension 4 minus d, if I am not mistaken. You see? It has dimension 4 minus d in terms of energies. So you see that it has dimension 0 in dimension 4. So in dimension 4, and dimension zeros is compatible with the fact that you have logs of lambda singular terms. Okay, well, of course, the mass squared has dimension 2 in terms of lambda. So this means the mass squared term has always dimension 2, so it means that you might have long lambda squared singular term. As soon as you assume that there might be terms which takes into account the fact that the theory is quantized with an ultraviolet cut off. Okay. And that's indeed what's happening. Okay. So this argument is just a dimensional argument which states that you have the possibility to have singular divergence. Let's go back to 5-4. So I will first consider a theory which is massless 5-4. Massless 5-4 theory. So it has an interaction. Okay, and massless means that the lowest excited state, the one particle quanta quantum of the theory, has mass as m physical equals 0. And you know, you have seen in QED that, for instance, the mass electron, the bare mass of the electron you put in the Dirac Lagrangian, is renormalized by quantum effects. It's renormalized by the famous diagram. Okay. QED, you compute the propagator of the electrons, and you get these radiative corrections, which contains a log lambda singularities. So that's a radiative correction. Of course, it's a correction of order h bar. It's a one-loop diagram. So exactly for the same reason, phi 4, the mass of the particle will have a radiative correction. And for phi to the 4, you can compute this radiative correction by simply computing the simplest is compute the inverse of the propagator, namely the irreducible 2-point function, which is given by this diagram, which represents p squared plus m squared. I'm going to see what is the mass of the theory. And then you have a factor. You have this diagram, so I don't remember for radiative correction, it's a plus or minus. I think it's a plus. And you have the famous g one half of this diagram, which is the diagram which corresponds to this. So that's the radiative correction to the mass of the phi 4 theory, which contains a lambda squared term. And of course, then you have higher order terms, which means that the physical mass is going to be the mass of the theory plus this radiative correction of that order. So let's see. Okay. So if I want a massless phi 4 theory, I need to start from a theory where the mass is not zero. That's the idea. And that's the general idea of renormalization. So in fact, the idea of renormalization, the basic idea, it's not an idea. In fact, it's a feature. You have to do that. Is that in order to define what are the masses, coupling constant, and etc., scattering amplitudes in a quantum theory. This is a quantum theory, so you must specify how you measure them. You must specify how they are measured. Well, measured means if you are an experimental physicist and if you are a theoretician, it means which calculation you must perform to obtain a result that you call, this is the mass, the spectrum of my theory, these are the coupling constant of the theory, these are my scattering amplitudes of my theory. In quantum theory, you have no, counterfactual experiments. You cannot think about an experiment that I'm not performing, but I'm thinking, what is the result of an experiment that I'm not performing? I think that's a statement by a famous quantum physicist, maybe Yuval Perez or whatever. So it's important when you are thinking about the paradox of quantum theory, evaluation of Bell's inequalities, etc. Because the issue of contextuality in quantum mechanics, I don't know if you have seen that already, but that's an important effect. Contextuality means in some sense that you must only think in terms of things related to an actual experiment. If you perform a Bell-like experiment and you think about it, you cannot think, if I had performed something else and if the electron had not changed state here, what would have happened? You must think of what you are actually measuring. Okay, so that's the same here in quantum field theory. So that's a feature of in quantum field theory as in quantum theory. Okay, in general. And so the general idea is that if I want to perform, to construct a quantum theory of I to the 4, I know it's given by a functional integral. I'm going to think in terms of functional integral, exponential. Well, let's write in terms of Minkowski in a Euclidean settings, but that's not very important. So it's minus an action. I set h bar equal 1 because I know now that I'm a diagram of order with one loop contributes by h, etc. And I want to construct a theory where I define, I measure scattering amplitudes of particles. And so phi here is the dummy, as you have seen already when deriving some equation, for instance, the Schwinger-Dyson equation of a phi-4 theory. Phi is a dummy variable. You are never measuring the phi which you have introduced to construct a functional integral, construct matrix element of operators. While you are constructing here are expectation value of operators like phi squared, I'm considering. And we have seen that, for instance, already at the level of phi squared, the phi squared operator associated to the mass, so measuring phi squared is somehow a way to measure mass, is not the naive phi squared, it's a functional integral. You have to define properly in order to have it. So this action, when you integrate, write it in terms of phi, well, we assume that phi four is a sensible theory, therefore that keeping phi squared and phi four term are enough. It turns out that it's true, but it's non-trivial. But I'm going to use as this action the most general action. Let's work in four dimension, which contains a kinetic term, a mass term, and the phi four term. But the most general action will contain such a term. You just have coefficients. So in my notes, I have written calligraphic A, calligraphic B, and calligraphic C. Well, let's keep the normalization here. So this is some kind of wave function normalization, field normalization. This is a mass term. This is a coupling term. But a priori, A, B, and C, you have to adjust them to measure the things you want in your theory. Okay, so this action, I'm going to call it R. R means renormalized. Action, because that's the action that you are going to have to use if you want to define two-point functions, four-point functions, which makes sense. The action, renormalized action, it means that the action which is the one that you have to use it in order to construct, if you want, a physical observable. Okay. So phi is a field which is just a field that you used. Okay. And at the classical level, if you do not take into account the radiative correction, of course, you can take A equal 1, that's the simplest. B turns out to be the mass, the classical mass of your Klein-Gordon field, and G, your classical coupling of a non-linear Klein-Gordon field. But because of this, it's not directly related to the mass. Okay? So you can compute with this theory irreducible two-point function. So for instance, the irreducible two-point function, let me call it gamma 2 of p, computed with this theory, given gamma 2 is given by this theory. The fact that it is massless means that I want that this vanishes at p equals 0, p squared equals 0, let's say. I'm in Euclidean, so that's the same thing. So that's a massless condition, massless physical okay. And we'll discuss the four-point function later on. Okay, so this is my fifth blackboard. So let's apply the rules of perturbation theory, starting from this action. Well, this gamma 2 of p is just, well, what is the propagator? Now, the inverse propagator is a p squared plus b. Okay. This is this, this line. And then I have plus classical, so that's a propagator like that, just inverse of the propagator, so the doubly truncated propagator. And then I have the contribution of this diagram, truncated diagram. I have a coupling, so it's C. I have a factor of symmetry 1/2. And I have this integral, which is just integral d4k times the propagator, but now my propagator is 1 over a plus ak squared plus b. Okay. And I want this to vanish at p squared equals 0. So first, you can see that at the classical level, you can take a equal 1. You can take a equal 1, because this doesn't depend on the momentum, because it's a tadpole diagram, which doesn't depend on the momentum p that flows through this line. This is the momentum k. And so this makes the equation simpler. And you can compute this integral. And you see that this integral is divergent. And the divergence of this integral, so this integral reduces to let's call the integral t, which is integral d4k over 1k squared plus b. And if you compute it, oh, there is a normalization. There is a normalization 2pi to the power of 4 over 4. Let's be precise. You can go to radial coordinates. by integrating, stating that k, this is a four momenta, is some unit momenta times k, some momentum of k, and you integrate u over the unit sphere in dimension 3. And the unit sphere in dimension 3 has volume 2 pi over 2, a volume 2 pi squared. We get a 4 pi to the power of, I'm sorry, 2 pi to the power of 4. This is the integration over u. This is the volume unit sphere in R4. And then you get integral over k, a factor k3, 1 over k squared plus b. Okay, and you see that you have to integrate from 0 to something large, and this diverges when k becomes infinite. So now we introduce a cutoff regulator. This functional integral is done with a regulator. And I'm going to use just the sharp cutoff regulator where the momentum is smaller than lambda. So I'm integrating from 0 to lambda. So my regulator is going to be simply that k is less than lambda, otherwise this is 0. Okay, so I hope that's an integral you are able to perform. And you find that this is, this depends on a bit of b. But we assume, of course, I assume that lambda is much larger than b, and you find that this behaves like, if I am not mistaken, I found that this is 1 over 4 pi squared lambda squared plus higher order terms. And if you have, if you are careful, you are going to find b squared log lambda divided by b squared with some coefficient plus some regular terms, but this I'm going to see that they are unimportant. This one is an important term. That's the divergence. Okay. So you see that this is going to be, well, I choose A to be equal to 1. I don't need to choose another one. Then I have B plus C over 2, 1 over 4 pi squared lambda squared plus an important term. And I want that gamma of p, I want the theory to be massless. So I want that gamma 2 of p is 0 at p squared equals 0. So I want this to be 0. That's my physical condition. That's a physical condition. That's my physical condition. Okay. So you see that you cannot take b equals 0 in your theory, in your action in the functional integral. Because if you take b equals 0, well, this term vanishes, but this doesn't vanish. So you must take, this implies that b is different from 0. And b has to be equal to minus 1 half 1 over 4 pi squared c times lambda squared. Now, I'm working at leading order in the coupling constant. In the bare theory, this would be the coupling constant. So if there were no loop correction, this would be the G of the classical action. And you see that when computing the two-point function, you have no terms which involve some change in the coupling constant. So I can take at that order C equal what I'm going to call a renormalized coupling constant. More later. That's a coupling constant I'm going to measure in an experiment like that. And then I found just that B is minus 1 half 1 over 4 pi squared G renormalized. So you have to choose, if you choose this for A, this for C, and this for B, you can check that this correction is of order B squared, but B is of order G renormalized. So this is the term of order G renormalized, next order. So final result with this choice, those choice, this, this, and this, gamma 2 of P is P squared, the classical action, plus terms of order at most G renormalized squared, which I'm neglecting. So my theory is massless, and it's the same as the free theory. Yes?
So where did the lambda squared go in the B expression?
I'm sorry, typo, very important typo. You have to take, of course, mass counter terms. This is called the mass counter terms. I'm sorry, that was the point. So thank you very much. You have a mass counter term in your original action here, renormalized action. You must take as a mass in your renormalized action a term with a mass in order for the physical mass to be zero. And well, you might be a bit worried because this mass is negative. Okay. Problem. This mass is negative. And theory is a negative square. Well, it's not the mass, it's a squared mass. So a mass negative means that you have a potential in your action which is something like that, and the particle is a tachyon. But we are dealing with an interacting theory. So we have a potential which is behaved like G renormalized phi to the 4, and with a mass squared term of order G renormalized. And therefore, they are of the same order. And that's the bare potential, if you want. That's the bare potential. which is of the form minus, so the bare potential is of the form G renormalized minus lambda squared phi squared plus phi 4. And we have seen that the field is of dimension, where is it written? Lambda. Dimension of the field is lambda. It's the same dimension that the ultraviolet cutoff, so that's something over the one. And in this unit, this is a perfectly well-defined potential which is bounded from below. So if you are not taking into account the quantum fluctuations, the integration over phi, this is a potential which has two minima. So it's a typical potential that you have, and you have symmetry breaking. But because of the quantum fluctuation, the effective potential, this is the bare potential, and the renormal, the effective potential turns out to behave like phi to the 4. Remember, I defined loosely what is the quantum effective potential, gamma of phi, over var phi, if you want, for the background field. If you compute it using this action, take into account the one loop diagram, you get that this effective potential behave like phi to the 4. It's quartic in the field here, which means that there are no quadratic terms, which means that the renormalized mass is 0. Okay. No phi squared term. This is the fact that the mass, physical mass, is 0. So everything is consistent. Okay. So constructing at one loop a massless phi 4 theory is easy. That's just, if you want, an appetizer for renormalization theory, but that's an important appetizer. Okay, counter term, you must introduce a mass counter term, which is proportional to lambda squared times the coupling constant. Okay, so now, I'm going to stick with the massless theory. With a bit of more work, you can construct a renormalized massive theory with a physical mass which is positive, non-zero, by modifying this procedure. But I think that's a bit more than an exercise. But, and I think I have some notes in my notes. But now I'm going to consider the important term, which is the what happened to the coupling constant. So what about the coupling? And that's the important point. For considering what is the coupling in my phi 4 theory, you have to go to the 4-point function. For simplicity, let's consider the irreducible four-point function. It's going to be related to the phi 4 term precisely this term in the effective action. So the amplitudes of the quartic term in the effective action is going to give you what is the coupling constant you can measure in an experiment. So we have to consider what is in the theory given by this action, where we have fixed A and B, but we have chosen C to be just a classical coupling constant. A classical coupling, what this action gives, so the irreducible four-point function. So the irreducible four-point function, you know, is given by those diagrams, this diagram. This is the classical term. You know, the irreducible zero loop graph for phi 4 is just one vertex where you truncate the line. Okay, so that's okay. And then you have the one loop diagrams. And the one loop diagrams are those one. You have irreducible, so you don't have legs, tadpole diagrams attached. You have these diagrams where you have four momenta, one, two, three, four, while plus the same diagram with one, three, two, four, plus the same diagram with one, four, two, three. Okay, so this is what I'm going to call the irreducible four-point function. It's a function now of four momenta, p1 up to p4, with, of course, p1 plus p2 plus p3 plus p4 equals 0. And in my original theory, this is going to be C, the coupling. There is a minus sign, I think. Minus. Well, let me check because that's important. You just follow the Feynman diagrammatic rule. Yes, you have C squared, and you get a factor minus 1/2. So let's rewrite it here. That's C minus C squared over 2. That's a one loop. That's a radiative correction to the interaction vertex. With the propagator given by, again, now the propagator is in the original theory 1 over a p squared plus b plus b. Okay. But b is of order gr. You see. Oops. Ah, again. Okay. Well, there is this. So this is a four-point function computed with this renormalized action. And I think it's fine. Okay, and those diagrams, those three diagrams, let me call them bubble amplitudes, so they're going to be neat. It's not the curly B of the mass. So this is a function of P1 plus P2 plus B of P1 plus P3 plus B of P1 plus P4, where B represents the amplitude associated to this diagram. And this diagram, P of P, is just the amplitude that I wrote there. So it's integral over the internal momenta that flows here, integral over d4k over 2 pi to the power of 4, 1 over k squared plus b, if you want, times 1 over p plus k squared plus b. Okay. And I want to integrate this for momenta, roughly speaking, smaller, than lambda. One has to be a bit careful because this is not symmetric, so one must be more careful. But basically, you see that this should contain a log of lambda divergence. And, well, maybe, I'm sorry. Those of you who are there, not even. So basically, the important point is that this diagram, if you have a total momentum P that grows there, you can guess what the divergence is. It's an integral of the form B4k over 2 pi to the power 4, 1 over k squared, 1 over k squared, because that's going on what's happening when k is large. You can do the same trick. You get a 2 pi squared over d4. So you get a 2 pi squared over 4 pi squared. And you get a you get a log of lambda squared. In fact, it's a log of lambda because you integrate over dk over k times k cubed over k cubed, so you get a log of lambda. So better write this as log of q squared times 1, which gives 1 over 2 pi squared log of lambda squared divergence. Okay, so that's the important point. And on Wednesday, we are going to see how we remove this singularity by renormalizing the coupling constant. So we have seen that we can take C to be G renormalized, and we have seen that in order to remove it, we have to take C to be what I'm going to call my renormalized coupling constant plus the GR squared times some counter term, which contains, of course, a log of lambda. But we are going to discuss how we defined G renormalized, because that's where the subtlety of renormalization enters in the game, and it has to. Okay. So, thank